is 12.
Hey folks, a little something different for you today. I'm here with an old friend of mine, as in I've known him for a long time, not that he's old. Daniel Steinhardt is here. He's from Epson, a little company that makes printers that you may have heard about, printers and a bunch of other things. But I wanted to have Daniel on to talk about printing from the standpoint of the importance of it and how people that may be afraid of printing today or somehow said, you know, I don't print. I put all my stuff on Facebook and Instagram and whatever. What's a print? I want to talk about that and get to the crux of why people should be printing, especially if you're an advanced amateur, beginner, or professional photographer. So Dano Steinhardt, welcome to the program, man. How you doing?
It's great to be here. It's great to see you and your Game of Thrones very symmetrical background there.
And right.
Yeah. I don't know. It's quite intimidating.
Wait, that's for your screenshot. There's for your screenshot. No, it's good. Yeah, thank you. This is a brand new setup. People that have been watching the show know that normally that's not my background. Normally my desk is actually flipped and the room is the background. So Trying something different. You gotta mix it up every now and then. So let's talk about this. So you're at Epson. Let's talk about your role at Epson. What does Dano do at the company called Epson?
Well, my title is marketing manager. My primary responsibilities are working with the creative professional markets and the marketing things that go along with that. It's primarily photography, but we certainly work with anybody that's a creative professional, be it a fine artist, an illustrator, and other markets. I also do video production, and because of some of the crazy background I had in the early days of printing, I've been been pulled into some color science things related to projection. Because of all the pain we went through early in printing, I can sit in these long, boring international color science meetings and understand what's going on.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk about that, because that, you know, we were talking before I clicked the record button about just sort of back in the day. You know, we won't have to go back. You won't have to put a timestamp on it, but back in the day, the printing experience was, hey, I got this brand new printer, got my ink in it, I got my box of paper, and you run your first print through it, and it came out magenta. And you're like, oh, okay, what did I do wrong? Okay, and now I got to understand all this stuff. You run another print through it, it comes out yellow. You know, this was me, you know. So let's talk about that a little bit. Let's do that a little bit deeper. I want to talk about the history of printing itself. You know, like you kind of touched on that a little bit. Back in the day, it was enlargers. Remember those? You know, we had enlargers, black and white, and then we went to color enlargers, which was a little more involved and a little less tolerance of temperature and all that. And then today, you know, it's file print. So talk to me about sort of the evolution of where things were in the digital printing world and where they are today.
How much time do we have?
We only have about 3 days, so make it quick.
I like to say, you know, if you were to take the entire history of photography from Niepce, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, when took that 8-hour exposure, the French street scene, and to kind of the beginning of the digital age, you know, that is like 95% of photography and digital. That term is just this little, you know, little flash, a little wink of the eye. And just to put in perspective how quickly and things have evolved. But as I've been with Epson a little over 20 years, but I was recruited from the Eastman Kodak Company. And this was when Kodak was Kodak, you know, amazing company.
Kodak moment.
What it was. So, and before that, I was a commercial photographer. I used to use 8x10 view cameras, shooting food for magazines in Chicago. But if you look, just a quick thing in the past, you know, the printing was always about black and white printing. And it was not an uncommon thing post-World War II for a lot of hobbyists to have dark rooms and advanced amateurs to do dark rooms. And if you define yourself as a professional photographer, you always had a black and white dark room. Yep. Color printing, as we know it, we call it now the analog world, and then it was called a color print. that slowly came in the kind of mainstream, 60s, 70s, but that was purely big labs, big photo finishing houses. It was difficult. You needed big processors. You needed temperature controls. You needed people and staff, and it was always the lab.
Yep.
And it'd be fair to say that traditional C printing, I've never met anyone that said, gosh, I just love the way my C prints used to be. there were revered print processes back there, like dye transfer. Some people remember Cibachrome, all these kind of things. But they're just kind of, they're in the past. It's kind of an interesting history lesson. I lived it, and that's where all this hair went in those dark rooms.
It's still in the dark room.
but the first kind of digital printing started really in the early 90s, and I was then a Kodak technical sales representative, which was a revered job, back in the analog days. In my territory were two zip codes in Manhattan, which we now know as the New York City Photo District. All my colleagues around the U.S., they had cars, and they had car phones that were literally screwed into the dashboard. But I had what was called a walking territory, because in two zip codes that I could walk the perimeter in 20 minutes, that was the intergalactic center of photography. And wow. I didn't need a car, but I always wanted one. Anyway, we started to see something called an iris printer start to hit the streets. And this is kind of the what is that thing? No one understood this thing. It was a printer designed for pre-press proofing markets, meaning, for those that are not familiar with that, in the old web presses, when you went to make a brochure or you were proofing a magazine, you needed to create a proof that everyone would sign off on. Some of them were called signature proofs. There were different brand names, but there was so much at stake, so much money involved when you made a brochure to print it, because once you started, you were committed to thousands, tens of thousands. You wanted a proof that would absolutely match, so there was no guessing and didn't have to redo things. So Iris was meant for that. It was this big thing, and it had a big rolling drum, and it had all this stuff. And at the start, there were a musician and the road manager who were really into photography. You'll know them as Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Matt Colbert, who was the road manager for Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Both of them had loved photography. Graham, who has become a good friend, and we don't talk about music, it's always about photography. He would tell you he was doing photography before music when his father introduced him to, I think he got a Rolleiflex, a twin lens reflex, and they went to the zoo, and they went home, and they waited till it was dark and put the curtains up, and they processed the film, and Graham said he was hooked. Like many of us of a certain age were hooked in the darkroom.
Yeah.
And Graham, it's a long story, but essentially all of Graham's negatives from Woodstock that he shot disappeared. Couldn't find them. But they had these proof sheets, and someone showed them how they could scan the proof sheets. That was the first time anyone heard the word scan. And then they printed them, and Graham talks about how they were amazing and what they would do, and how did this happen. It was done by a guy named David Koons, and he was working for Disney and the Imagination. These were geeks, serious geeks, early 90s. And Graham said, I've got to see this machine. I've got to get this thing. And then Graham and Mac, Graham purchased an iris machine. He says it was $126,000. And the first 10 minutes, they voided the warranty because they wanted to do good paper. They didn't want to use stuff to mimic what a magazine would be or, what a brochure would be. And they basically took Mac's wife's, they took his vacuum cleaner, and they jerry-rigged it on there to pick up all the dust that would come off the paper as the drum would roll. And they made the first true fine art inkjet prints. there was a computer, but there was no monitor. It was all tape drive. This was, yeah, definitely early days. But the quality was remarkable. The problem was those were dye-based inks. Dye-based inks are, the technical term is fugitive. We would know it as fades, and those things would sometimes fade while you're looking at it. It could move really quickly. So there were
this is great. Wait, this was great.
But I remember shortly after that, and what and then they started a business called Nash Editions. It was never meant to be a capitalist, you know, kind of a, we're going to make a lot of money and do stuff. They wanted to evangelize this as a great way to do photography and fine art printing, because so many people never loved the C print. And you know, a photographer, he's recently passed away, but maybe, do you ever know David Steckline?
No.
He was a great photographer of the West, and he was based in Idaho, and cowboy. If you see a cowboy image, it was, he probably shot it from, you know, 60s, well, yeah, 70s, 80s. But, you know, this was a common thing then. It's not today, but then it was like when you had a C print made at a lab, to a commercial photographer, it was always, oh, you know, how do you feel about this? Well, I forgive the lab yet again, because there weren't really good options. Now, all of a sudden, there's the promise that the photographer could take control, that it wasn't, you know, if you did color printing, it was magenta and yellow, remember? And it was, if you try to dodge and burn, you know, the old-fashioned way, all of a sudden, wherever you dodged would go magenta, wherever you burned would go green, you know, it's like out of control. And you can make,
you bring it back,
masks.
My PTSD, man. My PTSD is coming back.
It was like all the stuff we learned in black and white just didn't work in color.
No, you know? No.
Color was like rules, and you follow this, and remember, you know, you agitate this, and if you go over 1/4 degree Fahrenheit and this, you know, and you shift color, it would do this, it would do that. I can remember even in school getting some of those prints. We had to make them. In fact, we used to make them in this, we used to call it the French fryer. It was this basket system. You would pick up, put the prints in there, and you would dip it between the developer and the bleach and all. And it was always in the dark, so you always had to guess, am I going in the right one? You know, you miss. And then I was like, yeah. It wasn't fun.
None of that sounds amazing.
And then, you know, you would take some of those prints, depending on the manufacturer, all of a sudden you would dry mount them. And the heat, they would all of a sudden go cyan because of the heat, all sorts of problems. Anyway,
yeah.
So kind of in the early 90s, to kind of bring it to where we're going, of a sudden there were Iris machines everywhere. And the quality was different. You could print for the first time on fine art papers, cotton fiber papers, all the interesting stuff. There was still this concern about longevity and permanence. I think that company did improve those products over time, but this is about the time Epson introduced the first inkjet printer, and that did change the game, because now you went from tens of thousands of dollars, the first one was $126,000, into machines that were then 44 inches wide that were in the $5,000 range, and then all of a sudden smaller things were coming into play, and now you could do it yourself, but it was challenging.
Mm-hmm. It still wasn't easy. Yeah.
It was not easy. There were, I like this, you know, the term color management was used very extensively in those days. It'd be fair to say at that time amongst photographers, color management was, and this is around the late 90s or kind of an oxymoron. was not manageable. It was all over the place. There were people involved, and I don't want to sound like, you know, old. You know, I remember this guy, but do you remember Bill Atkinson?
Yeah, I do.
So Bill was this amazing guy at Apple, genius. I forgot all his, he did great things, but he loved photography. But he had all these same problems everyone had. So he developed what were known as the Atkinson profiles, which was a target of, I don't know how many different color patches, thousands or whatever. Because what he was trying to do then, if you remember in the analog world, you had curve shape, you know, black and white was an S curve. In color, it was an S curve for red, green, and blue. And then in the darkroom, if you tried to dodge and burn, well, your red curve would cross your green curve, and you know, this is, you'd have these cross curves, and it was basically live with it, or you know, take up, you know, real estate or fencing.
Yeah.
So what Bill tried to do is he created all these patches, because we still had this kind of on these curves, they weren't nice and smooth. You know, all of a sudden it would be jagged. All of a sudden it would dip around. He created profiles to straighten out the curve. I was watching this movie last night. It's an old movie. I like it, called Space Cowboys. And completely implausible, but you know, they're coming in too steep, and because they're on the wrong curve in the trajectory. And that's what Bill's profiles did. They just got them on the curve.
I see how your brain works. Printing and Bruce Willis movies kind of somehow.
Same thing.
Exactly.
You're either going to burn up, or you're going to skip off the atmosphere.
That's right. That's right. And starting, but only then with printing, you can start again with another piece of paper.
And now it was like, oh, now I can do color. Now these things. Now, and then as the technology continued to evolve, and Epson started producing really good profiles, and the printhead technology and the screening algorithms and all sorts of other technical things kept improving. And then color management became mainstream. As I recall, Photoshop 5, that rev, that is when full color management was possible. Of course, and here was the unfortunate thing then, and we're still living with it a little bit today, is all of that color management nomenclature comes from that old pre-press world. So things like relative colorimetric for your rendering intent go, you know, that's that's all from newspapers and magazines. Right. Absolute, there's four things there, and it's in Photoshop, you'll still see them there. There's absolute, saturation, relative colorimetric, not just relative, and then perceptual. And then people then would go, well, I use perceptual because it helps me perceive the way that I... No, it was all from newspapers. And absolute meant, if you choose absolute, it'll absolutely match, and then I'll sign this, and then I'm off the hook. That's where that stuff comes from.
Wow, I did not know that.
The useless information. I got more.
Thank you. Thank you. It's all right. It's already filled with useless information. So more.
But, you know, kind of fast forward today. Now we have software that just makes it easier to work with. You don't have to be a historian. You don't have to be a scientist. These are straightforward tools that you can use, combined with what Epson's mission has been from the start of entering the photographic market, is to continually evolve and build this amazing technology with the goal that the technology gets out of the way so you can focus on the photography. That's the ultimate goal for Epson. And whenever we do an exhibition, or, you know, we're at a trade show, you know, our ultimate goal is that you can't look at a print and go, oh, I can, that's an Epson print, because I can see this, I can see that. We've succeeded when it's all about the photographer and not about Epson.
That's fantastic. And that's the thing, you know, and I think that path that you just sort of illustrated, I identify with that, because I was in the dark room. I had printers, and I remember seeing absolute versus, you know, all that stuff. And it was like, you know, I even remember watching some of those Graham Nash videos, you know, where he's like, explaining fine art, high-end glissé printing and all this stuff. I'm like, one day I want to get there. I can do it. And I remember back then, I was like, it felt like I could never get there. I could never create a print at home that was what I wanted it to be. That I was like, okay, this is the physical representation of what I saw on the screen. It was always different. And I couldn't figure out why. You know, I know there's calibration and all that stuff in there, Mm-hmm. And then what I want to, I also want to talk about is, you know, the laboratory.
My wife's British. She'll say that along with aluminium. Yeah.
Aluminium, Zed, all that stuff. But the difference between having a printer at home sitting on your desktop, kind of like what you have behind you, a printer at home versus sending a TIFF file to your local lab. Let's talk about that a little bit and the differences and the power of having your own printing in your own hand, in your own house versus, sending the FTPing the file and waiting 5 days for it to show up. Where do you fall on that?
Well, today, it'd be fair to say, we encourage anybody to print, whether they do it themselves or they send it to a service bureau or to a lab. Mm-hmm. Many labs today are using our technology, and we encourage people to understand the technology, the name, so that they can be a better client for the lab. Mm-hmm. Hey, I want it on this kind of paper. You should know what is capable, and the labs will appreciate that. So, well, there still are a few labs doing C-prints. You'll still see that primarily in the wedding markets. The advantage there is volume. That's the one thing about, a C-print, you can still crank out tens of thousands of prints, in a short amount of time. Inkjet, we still have that thing. It's gotten a lot faster. But as far as maybe for those people watching this that have never printed, there's a couple of things about printing yourself that even if you don't have Frederick and my hairstyle and lost hair in a dark room, there was something when you were in a dark room, it was alchemy and there was some magic when you saw that first print, kind of develop in front of your eyes, and it was like, I've created fire. I am an artist. There was like this excitement. And to this day, when I see people new to photography, maybe they're in their teens, 20s, and they're making their first digital print, it's that same level of excitement of, oh my God, when you see this thing coming out of the printer, it's that same level of excitement.
Yeah, something you made. Yeah.
You don't necessarily get that kind of joy and excitement when you upload something to the web or Instagram. It's still, that's pretty cool. But there's something special when you have some kind of two-dimensional, three-dimensional object in your hands that you've created. So there's that level. Printing, I have found, this is me personally, I'm biased, I'm the Epson guy, so you'll have to filter that out. I think printing makes you a better photographer. Because when you, it's the same kind of comparison from those that do video production and still. And I do both. Still photographers can make the transition to video, but video people sometimes struggle going to still, because in still, we're laser focused on that border, on the lighting and the details and the contrast and the color and everything. With motion, things move around and there's other things going on and you're telling stories and that's all great. But when you have a print, it forces you to slow down and look. And when you look, sometimes you go, ooh, I didn't see that before. Mm-hmm. I should, need to edit the image, need to do things. Next time I can do this better. I can, the old analog things kick in. Well, maybe I should vignette and bring the corners in more. I want to draw my attention here. The print kind of makes you, I think, that better storyteller.
I agree. It's kind of like when you, like if you're writing a letter or you're writing some copy or something, you could stare at it on the screen all day long and write. But until, for me at least, till I print it out and then hold that printed piece of paper in front of me and read it, I'm like, how did I say the? Who talks like that, right? it's the same thing. You could be in Photoshop all day long and perfecting Lightroom, perfecting your image. You print it out and you're like, what the heck? You know, and you got to go back. Yeah, so I agree. Definitely.
My color science background would say, well, you're dealing with transmitted electromagnetic radiation versus, you know, reflective art. There's just something about you're looking at it here and you see things differently.
Yeah.
The other thing that I would encourage those that younger people have never printed, there's a certain joy, and it's a little bit of an ego thing, when you show those prints to other people and they hold the print. There's something tactile about that experience that says, ooh. Now, depending who you are, I never knew you had it in you. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you're a real photographer. You made a print.
There's a certain level that, at a pro level, it used to be if you wanted to get work in print advertising, there's less of that these days, but you would send to an ad agency the book. Now, the book meant your portfolio. Mm-hmm. And a portfolio is usually, it was all over the place. These big leather cases or some little small things, a whole variety of things. And people tried to outdo themselves with the presentation of the book. And a lot of inkjet printing became this great way to show the book versus, you know, even earlier when people would shoot on chrome and, you know, hold up a chrome to the light and go out the window, go, oh, this looks kind of blue, you know, that kind of. Mm-hmm. Today, you can send the book on a tablet. And many people do. I was talking with a very famous celebrity photographer who was up for a job, major ad agency in New York, and he always sends the book, the printed book. Yeah. And he was up against a bunch of other people who sent tablets. And he said, you know how I got the job? I sent the prints. Because an image on a tablet, on a phone, on the web, people tend to do this. Yep, yep, well, that's nice, yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. When you have a print, they slow down and they look at it.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't physically do that, but you look at it. And then if you really want to have the effect, you send cheap white cotton gloves. Well, it's important. You know, and you place the print very carefully. It might be a little overkill for them. And it kind of gives that little extra, this is important stuff. This is crafts. This is a craft. It's not weight like to everybody it, else. Right.
It has weight to it. It's real. It's not just existing in the matrix. It's out of the matrix in the real world. Dan, I want to have you talk a little bit about quality. So you talked about the iris, you know, those $100,000, then tens of thousand dollar iris printers and all that. Contrast that level of quality from those machines with what we have available today. And then the third piece of that equation is lab printing, which may also, like you said, have Epson printers in there as well. If I am a consumer and I'm looking and I'm like, yeah, you're right, I need to start printing at home. Am I compromising by getting you know, a reasonably priced home printer versus sending my images out to a lab, or versus what I would get a couple of decades ago from an iris printer?
Well, just to give us a little foundation, if we're talking about, say, printers like the new Epson P700, P900, these are 13-inch, 19-inch printers. Not necessarily the retail, you know, all-in-one printers that you would see, even though the quality of those is pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good, yeah.
But if you get into this level of printer, let's say the 13-inch ones, P700, you know, these are about, they're under, that one's about $800, you know, MSRP. The quality of that print, and you can make a 13 by 19-inch cut sheet size. You can also do rolls if you wanted to. It's very difficult to define it technically. I like to give the correlation to, if we think back to the analog world. So this print produced with this $800 printer that will cost, you know, a couple of dollars with ink and paper is vastly superior to a print that was produced with about $500,000 of equipment and a staff of five people.
Wow.
I was during these interesting times wherein I was cleaning out my attic and I came across stuff stuff that I thought was amazing that is now not amazing technically. Really horrible stuff. And I just look at what these things can do and the control that you have. You know, in the old days, it was, well, if you went to a lab and it was like, you want a glossy or matte? And that was it. Now you have all this control and you have all of this choice. And so quality-wise and the things you can do, and the technology itself is much easier. So for someone new and they want to print at home, there's a new software we have, which is for free, called Epson Print Layout. Simple, just follow the steps top to down, top to down. And it just works now. You know, and it's all the pain that we all went through 15 years ago. It's all fixed, it's all solved. And you have some choices to make. Oh, what paper would you like? What size would you like? There's still that perceptual relative thing, but I have an easy fix for that one. And you'll make a print that'll be remarkable. Now, the print's only going to be as good as who the photographer is.
Sure.
I like to tell people the printers are amazing technological wonders, but they're only as good as the file that you send to it.
Yeah. See, that's amazing. It's ringing in my head that the prints that you can get today rival those gazillion-dollar machines of years gone by and all that. That is just, you know, from somebody that has walked over those coals, you know, it's just like, okay. It should have been. My brain back then was like, how come this just doesn't work? I just want to make a print of that's on the screen to that over there, and it should look very similar. How do I get there? And it was hard, and now it's not, right?
But also, if you want to, for whatever reason, you don't want to print at home, you don't have the time, and you want to go to a lab, you can get that same level of quality. It's just, again, understand the technology, what's available, so that you can direct the lab as to what you want. But when you're driving, when you've got the mouse, you don't need a mouse to print, but it helps. Or a tablet, you know. You're in control, and you can do things that you could never do in the darkroom. But it's hard sometimes to explain to others, I want this, I want this, I want this, when you can just very simply do it yourself.
Yeah. And sometimes you want to be quick and serendipitous, like, oh, I got people over, I want to give them a print of this thing, you know, and share it right then. You know, there's a couple of directions, and we're good on time, right? Yeah. So a couple of things I wanted to chat about. You know, today we've got a ton of people, and we talked about this a little bit before. We got a ton of people that are on Instagram, and they're using Instagram as their main distribution mechanism for the photography that they do. It goes from, you know, from photons to the camera sensor to the memory card to Instagram, rinse and repeat, and nothing in between. What those people that are doing that, from Epson's standpoint, how do they interact, or how do they interject the world of physical atoms versus electrons into their workflow? Like, what would you suggest for those people that are doing that workflow over and over and shooting for the likes, you know, and the hearts on Instagram?
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago that the only way you could see what you photographed was to make a print.
Yeah.
And of course, that's changed, you know, from a variety of different ways. And yours truly is all over Instagram. I love it. It coexists with everything that we do. For those that have only known Instagram or only see the value in it, we're finding that, especially as more and more people are on Instagram, and it's harder and harder to get followers and get likes or segregate from the rest, that several of those people find that there's a new income stream by selling prints. And Instagram is becoming more of a profit center, is maybe not the right word, but more and more photographers, that is their primary mission,
yeah,
and they get work from that but also, and they're looking for sponsorship and, you know, but the more followers you get, then you can build a certain audience and you can do different things, but that's getting harder and harder to do as a photographer. So we're seeing a lot of those people actually selling prints now and using their followers to get the word out about those prints.
For the folks that are, that, you know, speaking to the, I don't even think it's a generational thing, but, you know, the back in the day it was, you know, desktop computers, Quadra 950s, remember the Quadra Max and all this stuff. And then it kind of segued into portable computers and MacBook Pros and all that. And then today, you know, a lot of younger people are like, you know, I don't even own a computer. I do everything on my phone and on a tablet. You know, if I really want to get serious, I'll use a tablet. Talk about that world a little bit. Is Empson like sort of addressing those people that may do the majority of their photo editing on mobile and portable devices? Because these devices, especially iPads, are, you know, more powerful than a lot of the Quadra 950s or all of the Quadra 950s of back in the day.
A lot more powerful. Sure. we recently took Epson Print Layout, the software that's been available on the desktop, and we just introduced mobile versions of it for both iPad and for iPhone. Right now it's iOS only. We're looking at, you know, the other platform. But yes, and it takes all of the ease and the simple way to approach printing that we do on the desktop with Epson Print Layout and allows you to do that on the iPad, where, at least my observations, these are just, here's a little insight. So at Epson, you know, we have a research department and they'll run statistical studies, and for your viewers, that, you know, they run all the right things. And whenever I see N minus one, I go, oh, yeah, okay, it's going to get serious. But I, as the marketing manager, I'm out in the field and I see people, and there's this term that our research department has coined called danecdotal, a play on anecdotal. Well, anecdotally, we're seeing this. It's always correct, but they can't statistically prove it.
I love that. I'm using that. I'm going to use that.
It's anecdotal. You know. But anecdotally, we're seeing a lot of people that are artists, graphic designers. Really, the tablet is almost their primary computer. Yeah. And some photographers, the tablet becomes a much, is their, they've gone from desktop to laptop to notebook to that. The phone is slowly becoming a more professional device, but there's also a lot of you know, a lot of selfies and fun stuff, you know, on the phone. But the phone is also becoming a device. So yeah, that we're seeing that, and we're making this software available to do that. I was going to see if there's a way I could demo it here, but I don't think so. I mean, I can show you how it looks, but it's not going to look too good. But
yeah, we'll link to it. I'll link to it from the blog post for sure.
I mean, I have a little PowerPoint thing here. I could show you how it works, but it absolutely works. And I and my colleagues inside, we beta or alpha test these products. And we were looking at this several months ago. Honestly, I thought, oh, wow, fully color managed software workflow on the phone, you know? Yeah. It works.
It does.
It works.
See, that's so interesting, because I like, you know, we were talking offline a little bit about the twitch.tv or community over there, and there's a vibrant community of younger photographers. Well, you know, there's a lot of across the spectrum of photographers, but there's a contingent of younger photographers that are in there, and some of them are using iPads as their primary, you know, way of editing their images. It goes in editing wedding work on just an iPad, and it looks fantastic on there. And I, as an old guy, I go in there, I'm like, really? Come on. In my day, we had all our photos were on punch cards, and we that's not real photography on iPad. But in all seriousness, the work looks every bit as good, in some cases better than anything that you'd see on a traditional desktop or laptop computer. So, sure. Yeah, kudos to Epson for addressing that.
I should say, just to that the Epson print layout for iPhone and iPad at this time only works on the new P700 and P900, 13-inch okay. printer, 17-inch printer. The desktop version works on a lot more printers. But this is, you know, it's basically recently launched and it's out there. And the software, this is the best part, software is free.
Well. Well, let's talk about the product line a little bit, because I'm curious. We talk about there's a lot of options, obviously, for photographers. There's a grid matrix in terms of, you know, papers and you know, everything. You know, you could pick what you want, and it's easier to get from image that's in your mind's eye or in Photoshop or Lightroom out to the printed surface to, you know, to present. But what does that look like in terms of cost for the photographer? You know, from an enthusiast that's not making money from photography, but wants to print and maybe hang stuff on the wall, all the way through to the pro commercial fashion wedding shooter that needs to do, you know, maybe not volume work, but they need to print a couple, you know, 100 images and they all need to look good. What's the lineup for those people?
Well, to think in terms of size, mm-hmm. and printers come 13 inches wide, 17 inches wide. That's kind of the desktops. And then you go to 24 inches wide, 44 inches wide, up to 64 inches wide. I don't, wow. 64 is, that's a big deal. Now you're back into what it was like 20, you know, and these printers are amazing. They're not that big. And you think, wow, that's great. Until the print starts coming out, you go, where are we going?
Where are we going to put this thing? Need another room to hang my prints.
You know, rather than go into all the MSRP of all these kind of printers, the way I like to think of it is the 13 inch is kind of that entry level, getting going, learning from it. But it's the 17 inch printer that's kind of the sweet spot, because it started out as, oh, if you're of a certain age, I'm nowhere near as old as you, but, you know, no, if you're a certain age, there was the print that was the creme de la creme was 16 by 20. If you could do 16 by 20 in the dark room, because anything bigger was a nightmare. And the 17-inch printer, which really can do cut sheets 17 by 22, does the 16 by 20. There's just something about that size. I did make a couple just to show you. I don't know if you'll see this now. So this is a 17 by 22 print. This is on the legacy textured paper printed on the new P900. And here's a 13-inch print. This is on a glossier paper, which is still terrific size. And that's, you know, but there's something about when you get to this size, it's nice.
Yeah, you know? That is nice.
And it's very versatile and allows you to do things. And of course, there's letter size prints, and those are great. But in some ways, the way to think about it, if you're into photography, and yeah, you're going to buy a printer, yeah, you're going to be buying some ink and some paper, I like to think of it as it's kind of like buying a good lens for your camera. It's about the same price point, depending on what lens, what camera. We could have big arguments about that one. But it's actually, and depending, it could be a little less, it could be a little more, but think of it as you're buying a lens as far as, you know, kind of total cost, and then you're in business. And if you can sell prints, then it pays for itself or it doesn't. But also utilizing the built-in color management stuff. There used to be an old joke in the old days that, Epson doesn't want this color management to work because people are going to burn through a lot of ink and paper trying to get a decent print. Our goal is not that. Our goal is, sure, we want you making a lot of prints, but we want each one of those prints to be exactly what you wanted and have that experience, not wasting anything. And it does that today. You know,
I love that.
I'm sure in your days, you made a print and it was like, and then you probably put on your old analog roots, it's magenta. So you started chasing your tail. I'm going to put green in there. You put green in there, and then this guy, you know, it's like my golf swing. It's a series of compensating errors.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Roy G. Biv, right? Roy G. Biv.
Those days were over.
Yeah, I literally had above my printer and by the workstation the color star with with the colors on there. So,
you were using it. Yeah, you were using a ring around. Yeah, you're. Oh, yeah.
You remember the ring around? Yes.
Yeah, I saw it in a history book, I think.
Yeah. So crazy. So crazy. Hey, Dad, while I have you, I have a question. I'm hoping you can, apply some Epson official logic to this argument. So, in the TwitPro community, there's been an ongoing discussion about presentation of prints. And should you, and the gist of it is, some people think that every print you create should have a border on it. Within Photoshop, you should put a black border or a white border and maybe even a key line around the image because it presents the image better. There's another camp, I'm not going to tell you which camp I'm in, you probably can guess, but there's another camp that says the print should be the print, and if you want to add presentation to it, that should be done in the real world with physical mats and physical frames. Where do you fall on that? You, Dano, I know it's subjective. You, Dano, personally, where do you fall on that?
Well, as long as it's a print, I'm not biased.
As long as you're printing, I don't care what you do with the pixels.
I would say, if you were to come to a trade show where we're exhibiting, when we can exhibit again, right now we're doing things virtually, and I manage all of that in photo trade shows, each one of those prints is simply and elegantly framed with a consistent, simple mat.
Yes.
In that case, I do have to stay within certain constraints on size based on trade show properties. So what I want to do is maximize the size of the print. Frankly, it shows off what Epson technology can do. And then I will use the software I was talking about to get the size I need exactly to get as large as I can get and fit with the mat and things I want to do. But if you're a person that likes deckled edges, or you like to use stroke lines, or you like to have multi-things, or you print on canvas and you do wraps, and some people like mirror wraps, and some people like blurry wraps, and some people like solid wraps, if you're printing, that's the important thing.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Good answer. That's right on the line. Very, very Dano right there. Perfect. All right.
Here's a little hint.
Yeah.
And it comes a little bit from my color science background and how human vision works. And it's just something to keep in mind that it does relate to borders. And for those people that like those big white borders, I'm not making any judgment, but you should be aware that as human beings, we are innately drawn to highlights and contrast. And if you print with very large white borders, it will, at the limbic system of our anatomy, make your print look a little darker, because essentially when you have that much white surround, your eye is stopping down like an f-stop.
Yeah.
That may be appropriate. And I always find when I'm doing that, and if I can't control the lighting, I have to make the print, and there's a need for a white border, I have to make the actual image area a little lighter to compensate for the effect of that white surround.
Does a reverse happen if you put a black border on there? The print just looks darker and your eyes open up a little bit?
It's no different. I hate talking like I'm an old man, but in the old days.
Own it, man. Come on. I've owned it. Just own it.
The concept is the same. When we used to shoot transparency film, 8x10 magazines, chromes, remember those? The way you would do this shoot, the way you would impress the art director was you turn off all the lights in the studio and you would put the chrome on top of the light box, and then you would put black mask all around it so that chrome just glowed and go, wow, look at all that stuff. Then came the angry phone call a couple weeks later when it printed so dark in the magazine. Because when you see how they printed magazines, they would take that chrome, put it in a light box next to a light banging down on it. And that's where that old four-stop photography, you know, a chrome could hold this much information, but the print can only do this. And where do you... So yes, same concept. But a print, you have more control. So, yes, beware of the big white border because it could distract from your image.
I love that. Sage words. So I want to give you the last word on this, Daniel. So there's a saying, I forget who said it. You will know who said it, I'm sure. But I don't know if it was Ansel Adams or someone, but they said that the print is the punctuation at the end of the sentence. Where do you fall on that? Is the print the punk, especially, and I know you work at Epson, so of course, you know, you're going to say, yeah, but just like when you look at it from the standpoint of, you know, we're in 2020, moving into 2021, and most images are shared online. But since we've been talking, millions of images have been shared online, right? So most images are shared online. In the context of all that, is that still true? Is it still true that the print, the physical embodiment of the pixels in the file on your screen, the sentence is not finished until you output it to Adams? Where do you fall on that?
Well, honestly, I use Instagram. I love it. You can look at my site. We use it all the time. For me personally, I kind of fall back on my mentor, who is Jay Mazel.
I've heard of him.
And Jay, Jay has many things to say. But when it comes to the print, he said it's the print in which you can build your reputation.
I love it.
And I always remember that.
Yeah, I love that. I love it. Daniel Steinhardt, where can people go to see your work or to connect and see all these Epson printers, et cetera? What's the best place for them to go?
Well, the most important thing is to go to the Epson site, which for photography is printyourlegacy.com. Oh. And you will see the entire Epson professional printers and media, signature-worthy media and legacy papers. And then we also have a YouTube channel that I've put together to teach people about some of these things, how to use the latest software, and that's a YouTube channel, and it's epson.com/printacademy. And two more are the new Epson Pro Instagram site we started exclusively for the professional community that we've encouraged many of your viewers to follow and join and be part of. And that is at Epson Pro Photography.
Pro Photography.
And then if you're really bored, you know, you could look at my Instagram, which is @Dano_Steinhardt.
Steinhardt.
I think the other stuff's more informative.
All right. Yeah. So we'll go in that order. You know, Epson, printyourlegacy.com, the YouTube channel, epson.com/printacademy, and then follow Epson at Epson Photography, @EpsonPhotography. And then lastly, if you have time,
yeah.
Epson, what is it? Epson Pro Photography?
It's @EpsonProPhotography. That's the Got Instagram it. Handle. And mine is @Dano_Steinhardt, where you'll see all the images that I like to say were taken between meetings, which is true. These are all things I've shot between meetings while I'm collecting all that anecdotal information.
You should have named your Instagram account Danecdotal. Come on. I'm gonna go register that right now. No,
okay. All right. Well, yeah. We'll go 50-50, huh?
There you go. I'll register it and then trade it for a printer. There you go. There you go. You're like, what am I laying around here? Cool, man. Well, Dano, thank you for doing this, man. I appreciate your time today. This has been informative. I'm excited about printing, and I'm excited that obviously Epson is serious about printing, but I'm excited about how serious Epson is about reducing the pain between what you see on the screen and what you see in the print. Because we as photographers, we just want to see what we created in Photoshop come to life on a print and not have to be technicians in the middle of all that. So yeah, thank you and kudos to Ebsen for that.
Great, thank you.
All right, take care, Dana.
This is Twitter.